one's going to be CSS by Neil. I'm Bill Oakey, and I just kind of want to get a sense of folks here. How many folks do development, like software development, as opposed to, say, you know, sysadmin or whatever? Okay. How many of those developers do web development, more or less?
I've done a web page or two.
Okay. So that's good. I'm going to go ahead and this is actually Scott's slides. I had another presentation that I gave a while back, but it was to folks that were really hardcore web developers. So this is a set of Scott's slides. And before I get started, I actually have a personal note. I'm sitting here 10 minutes ago, and I realized 20 years ago today, I was on my way there. Interestingly enough, that might be hard to see. I was on a night train from Munich to Berlin. And so, happy anniversary to me. It was a very cool experience. That's not me. That's a guy who's taken a sledgehammer to a big old concrete slab of the wall, and the East German border guards from the other side are shooting water to try and keep people from doing that.
This is from the
New York Times. But I have a bunch of photos and got myself a nice big slab about that big.
Whoa!
Until the West German border guards came along and shunted all of us away.
Oh.
It was very, very interesting experience. So I was crammed into a train compartment with about four Germans and four other Americans, and the train was just packed, and we were all creaking our way along to Berlin. So, very interesting experience. So this is actually the presentation that we're all here for, or at least ostensibly we're here for, which is Scott's set of slides on using cascading style sheets. Now, I would assume the folks who do web development have done some level of CSS. You would have had to in order to make stuff draw, at least minimally. So this is really going to be, you know, for some of y'all, it might be pretty introductory. But for those who are interested in web development or might be interested in web development in the future, knowing about CSS, at least at a very basic level, is kind of a prerequisite for really doing web development these days. Especially now with the advent of HTML5, you're going to see a number of the presentation elements, things that you used to use in HTML, to lay things out like the bold tag and center tag, and that stuff's all going to go away. Everything's going to be done with CSS. So,
I'll be darned.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Are you going to cover anything going from frames to CSS?
I'm sorry.
From frames to CSS.
Frames to CSS. I was not going to cover that. These set of slides don't cover that at all. Frames, you mean like the HTML frame element, right? Yeah, in fact, the entire notion of frames is going away in HTML5. That's another thing. You will still have iframes, but frames themselves are actually getting shunted aside. They don't have very good usability characteristics or accessibility characteristics, especially for people that, you know, need to use screen readers and things like that. So
my uses of it is really, really simple.
Yeah. They're really trying to get people to migrate much more toward use a page and put an iframe in a page, because that's kind of really where things are heading much more. And then you can style that iframe using CSS. So, you know, you can make it look like a frame set, but...
Yeah, you have to say CSS makes it look, you get the same effect without the difficulty of the frames.
Right.
Okay. You'll be available afterwards, right?
I will be available afterwards. So let me start going here, because... Okay, so here's a bit of the history. CSS 1 came out in December of 96. Before, you know, kind of pre-CSS, there was all this stuff in HTML that, oh, well, we're going to put in bold tags and italic, and we're going to, you know, strike and all of that stuff. And they said, whoa, you know, what started to happen is HTML is really about semantically marking up the content, not how you present it on the screen to a visual user in some cases and a non-visual user in others. So the CSS guys, you know, really the guys who are deeply involved with Opera as a browser, started the CSS effort. And so here's some different dates as to when these came out. And really CSS 2/2.1 is kind of the current where everything is at this point. IE8 finally implements CSS 2. It only took Microsoft 10 years. They're a little strapped for cash, developers, I know. CSS 3, you're starting to see aspects of that show up in Firefox and Safari and Chrome, Google Chrome. There's actually a few tiny bits of it in IE8, even in IE7, amazingly enough. So, but that's kind of where the history of how things more or less developed. Now this is Scott's chart here, but actually taken right out of Wikipedia. It is more or less accurate. Here's the different rendering engines, and so these will, because when we talk as web developers, we talk about things, we don't necessarily talk about a particular browser. We tend to talk more about rendering engines, especially in a topic like CSS. So these are the code names for the various rendering engines. The Microsoft one's called Trident. That's their engine they use inside of IE. The Gecko engine's used for all different branches of Firefox. So you know, you might have Firefox and you have Camino for Mac OS, but they're all using the Gecko rendering engine. WebKit engine is used by both Safari and by the Google Chrome browser. Even though they have different JavaScript engines, they both use the same WebKit engine. And then the Presto engine is what's used by Opera. So those are the different code names. And what you can see here is kind of the support. And this has gotten pretty significant. The CSS 2.1 support at this point is pretty solid. This is a little bit older of a chart. 8.0 here will completely implement it. 1.5 here pretty much completely implements Modulo, a few bugs. Yes, sir?
So does that mean that if you're still in IE6 for whatever reason, you're out of luck?
Yes. Yeah, it's pretty
much broken.
There's quite a few aspects of CSS 1 that work in IE6. Most of the rest of it does not. IE6 is...
Hard, is
a 10-year-old. I got a buddy of mine that works at Google. He said that 53%, they did a big measurement because that's what they do there. They measure everything. 53% of their engineering effort is spent on supporting IE6. So they develop all the software first for everybody else. That pretty much takes 47% of the effort. And then the other 53% is all spent hacking, trying to make it work in IE6. So, and they're rapidly moving toward a world where certain of their properties will stop supporting IE6. This is another chart which might be difficult to see. This is basically taken from a website called quirksmode.org, which is actually a very good resource for all the different little bits. I'm going to write that up here. I don't know if anybody can see it, but I'm going to go ahead and write the bottom. Yeah. Is it? Okay. Yeah. People might have trouble seeing that, though, so I'll put it up here. Quirksmode.org. And that's a great resource if you run into problems or things. Well, why is it working on this browser and not on that browser? And he goes in, and this guy's written a whole bunch of tests. And so this was kind of his chart for CSS 2 and CSS 3 in the various browsers. Okay, so why CSS? We touched on this already a little bit. The notion is that you can separate the style from the semantic content. So we're separating the content from the presentation, the content being the... Yeah, go ahead, Craig.
What do you mean by semantic?
Well, for instance, you might say I have a heading here, or I have a paragraph there, or something like that. But that necessarily doesn't really relate to the end user how that should look. As Scott states here, you might have different styles that apply. You know, you might want to see that paragraph in a different way if you're browsing it on your mobile phone as opposed to browsing it on a full-size, 30-inch monitor or something.
So you're describing the content, not how the content looks?
Describing
the pieces of
the
content?
Yes, right.
Your top statement there says that.
Right. You've got the markup is giving the structure, the kind of, semantic meaning of of what the page should be, paragraph here, heading there, and the CSS is kind of giving a how it should get laid out, how it should look. With this, by separating this, we can have rules, CSS rules, that we can apply site-wide. And since we don't have a lot of duplication of effort, you know, if you had HTML and you had a lot of stuff embedded in your HTML, this should be bold, this should be whatever, then the problem is if you want to change that, you have to go in and edit all those HTML files. By separating this out into CSS, we can say, well, just make all of those kinds of things bold and with one instruction. And we'll see examples of that later.
Do you have a version of this you can give to everybody that does a Word document?
I'm sorry?
Do you have a version of this you can give to everybody that does a Word document?
Yeah, I wish. I mean, the Microsoft HTML and XML exports don't tend to be all that friendly with how this actually works, or it's intended to work by the W3. But that's pretty standard stuff for them.
You represent the content in HTML or in XML?
Well, you represent the or in XML. You know, actually, you can use CSS actually with either one. Now, most browsers, IE accepted, because IE is not what they call an XML or XHTML user agent. That's the W3 term for a browser. Because it's not, it does not recognize XML. If you shove an XML file at IE, it brings up the tree view, you know, that allows you to browse your XML. Other browsers will actually take, if you've defined a CSS instruction and there's a different instruction than what you use in HTML, in the top of your XML document, it will try to style that XML and lay it out.
So,
and then there's this concept of XHTML, which is just kind of a slight reformulation of HTML into XML following its rules. And so this is all being standardized by the W3, so you know, by doing this also too, you kind of adhere to their set of standards. And if you're running in a browser environment that actually adheres to those standards, you'll get a very consistent experience for your users. We're going to talk a little bit now about selectors and how this works. So in your HTML, you might have something like an element name, you know, span or something like that, and then an attribute equals value. So I'm sure everybody has more or less kind of seen these HTML chunks around. CSS would say, you know, if you break down a CSS rule, this entire thing is considered to be a rule. You have a selector, and then you have one or more property name value pairs. So this is the name, value, etc. Scott's put up some examples here. This is I'm not sure, can people see this font? I'm not sure. This is a P, which is a paragraph element in HTML. And what this says is all P elements should have a font size of 12 pixels. So if you have a HTML file that has a bunch of P's in it, and you take a CSS sheet that has this instruction in it, and you link those together, and we'll talk about how we link those together, then all your P's, there are no other rules that override that, all your P's will end up having their text content be 12 pixels. So you can see how this is nice from a site maintenance perspective, because later on, if you decide, hey, I want to make it 14 pixels, you go into one instruction and you change it, and it ripples through your site. Here's another example of another selector, and this dot here means something. We'll talk about that. But basically, it's making all the color of the text red. Here's another one. And in this case, we have something called a font family, and you can actually put multiple values in there, comma separated. So here's some various examples of CSS instructions. Okay, is this kind of clear or not really clear? Okay. So Scott brings up a good point here. You wouldn't normally do this in a CSS sheet because it becomes hard to maintain after a while, right? You're being very repetitive. It's like, set all P's to have red text, set all P's to have font size 12, set all P's to have a font weight of bold, set all P's to have Verdana. And so what you would do instead of that is you can combine those into a single rule.
Sure.
Right? For maintenance. There's actually 14 different kinds of selectors. We're going to talk a little bit about the basic set. We're not going to get into the, some of the really sophisticated selectors. And all selectors are, an easy way to think about it, especially if you've done, ever done like database work, for instance, is CSS selectors are a way of querying the document that you've linked against. So that's really what a selector is. It's a query, and it returns the CSS processor a set of elements, and then the CSS processor then applies these declarations to those elements, moves on to the next rule. So it's a set of queries. There's different kinds of selectors. There's a type, some people call that element, class, ID. We'll talk a little bit about grouping selectors, talk a little bit about the universal selector, and we'll delve just a little bit into what are called combinators. So type selectors or element selectors are basically match HTML elements. So we've already seen this, right? If you want to match the P element, you know, this will result in every P being red and having red and bold content. Is that pretty clear to everybody? So, you know, the name of the element, no punctuation, is just a simple element selector or type selector. It has some advantages. It changes every instance of the HTML element, and that, of course, also its disadvantage.
And what's a P? Just as the
just
page
a paragraph.
That's being displayed. This depends on how that person
that's
that
correct.
Page set it up.
That's right. That's right. That's going to be marked up in your HTML document, those little P's. So you might have said start, you know, the guy who did the HTML document, which might be you, but it might not be you, decided, oh, well, I'm going to start a new paragraph here. So I'm going to put in a start P, then I'm going to put some content, then I'm going to put an end P. Right? And so what you can do then is to come in and say, ah, I want it to now all be red whenever it hits one of those. Where this is really powerful is in use, especially in environments where you have to be ADA compliant. Because what you can do is, you can come out with an alternate style sheet that would, you know, for instance, blow the text up 300% for somebody that's visually impaired. And by not embedding that presentation, how the P actually gets rendered in your markup, you now allow it to be very flexible so that, you know, they can just say, oh, if you're visually impaired, use this set of style sheets.
And many browsers now say, here's a place to, what alternate style sheets do you want to use?
Right. Yeah, even IE8 has finally caught up with the ability for the user to define the style sheet that they want to view a particular website with, which is kind of cool. You will use element selectors quite a bit. You know, you should use them with caution. Interestingly enough, most of the modern web browsers now are purely a rendering engine, and they actually contain a built-in, we'll talk a tiny bit about that, a built-in style sheet that actually tells it when you hit this particular thing, you're supposed to render in this fashion. And you can then override those rules, which is kind of, in some sense, what you're doing here. Now we'll talk briefly about what's called class selectors. Sometimes we want to define a rule that can be applied to any element that meets a certain criteria that's not necessarily its tag name or element name. So what we can do is we can use what's called a class selector, and a class selector is one that would match a class attribute on that tag. So what you see here is I have a paragraph, and then I've said class equals attention. Okay? And then in my rule, I started it with a dot that tells CSS I'm defining a class, not an element name, and I'm going to now define my rule. Okay? So the interesting thing about this is that I don't know, I could put class equals on all sorts of things. I could put it on all sorts of elements throughout my hierarchy of HTML elements. So it kind of allows me much more flexibility and freedom as opposed to saying do all P's. I might say do all P's and all spans and all, you know, whatever, elements, divs and things, and I want them all to be this way with a single rule.
I'm missing something.
Yes, sir.
Note the lack of a dot. Where is it talking about the lack of a dot?
Right. What he says here is that when you define class equals in the markup, you don't put the dot here.
We're not defining it. We're calling it.
Yeah, we're calling it. Sorry. You're saying this P should have this class, but you only put the dot when you're defining it in the CSS sheet, not when you're applying it to the.
Oh, okay.
Not when you know there's no dot. That's what he means right here.
Can I make a comment really
fast? Yes, sir.
When I use OpenOffice, the Word, or the writer, I think it's called, you can save in HTML format, and it'll actually present a style sheet at the top if you look at it.
Right.
It's how I've learned how to start programming in CSS.
Yeah, that's a great way to do it. Yeah.
It's really a suggestion if somebody's trying to learn, make a simple example, and then just look how the writer produce the CSS.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a great way to do it.
That's OpenOffice, like their Word
writer.
Writer, which is their Word component. Yeah. Yeah. I would not try to follow to do that with Word. I would actually not use any Microsoft products if you actually want to know best practices for anything. You can apply that across the spectrum. So
putting those slash P's at the end are a pain.
Yeah, they are, but the interesting thing is
Microsoft leaves them off.
Right. The thing is that HTML does not require those. There are certain tags in HTML that do not require a closing tag. P is one of them. That's because HTML is actually based on an older standard called SGML. But XML requires them. So if you use XHTML, you have to close with the closing tag. It makes those of us who actually do that machine parsing thing a lot happier when you close things.
How does this affect like Perl modules like CGI.pm and so forth?
It wouldn't.
Okay.
Yeah. This is operating at a different level. You know, this is really operating much more at the user level, what the user's seeing. So this is just kind of a variation on the theme. This is, I attached the attention class only to P elements. Okay, this is a further qualification, if you want to think about it, again, in query terms, right? Now, it's only P elements that have class attention. If I have other ones, like this HR, that has class attention, it will do nothing. So you can get very specific in your query, if you want to think of it that way, to match rules. To match elements in the document.
Are there a set of predefined classes, or do you just make them up as you go?
You make them up as you go. There's some best practices around naming, but there are no set of predefined classes. There's a set of predefined elements, obviously. I think there's 96 or 97 HTML tags, although that number's going to shrink a little bit in HTML5 because they're getting rid of about 8 or 10 of them. Yes, sir?
Is there a way using CSS... Let's say you've got a paragraph, and let's say it's everything bold, given size, type, font.
Right.
You want to drop out of that font. I've been doing everything manually to drop out of bold, to put something else in, or change the color. So on the same line in the same paragraph, you're dropping out, and I'm doing it with HTML to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But is there a way within CSS to do it?
Well, yeah, you would put a. You still have to delineate that section, right? Okay. So you still have to block it out in a sense. Although I won't use the word block too much because it has a specific CSS meaning, but you have to define that. So you'd have to put a span in there.
Right.
You put a class on the span. There's also other ways of doing it from a selector perspective. We'll talk briefly about that. Part of it is that if you're able to detach yourself from an IE6 world, the number of selectors that you can use. Actually grows by quite a bit, and you can do some more sophisticated queries that you don't have to go in and just, you know, be littering classes everywhere in your document. Okay. So, So I guess that was the same slide as the last one. Again, reiterating, we have a classic title on P. That's going to match this, which is going to make it bold and center and 16. Mm-hmm. Blah, blah. Okay. CSS class names. Here's actually a very nice little candy guide.
Don't put a space on them.
Do not. That's what we got them, and we got them. I like this chart here. I'm going to steal it from him, I think. So, you know, it's the standard, mostly word characters. You can start with a dash, although I would not recommend it at all, partly because the vendors tend to use prefixes that start with dashes to mean a specific property will only work inside of their browser. Officially, it's legal, but same with underscore. It just makes it a little harder to read. Definitely never start them with a space. I don't think that will even parse. Don't start with a hash mark or a minus hash mark. The hash mark we're going to talk about in a minute because it's used for another kind of selector.
With this table, is there some relationship between the left and right side of the same line?
No. So he has some examples here. Bad, good. I try to make my class names a little more domain specific sometimes. I probably wouldn't use things like center. It depends. Depends on what I'm doing. But
it's a center block on the page.
Yeah, if it's a center block on the page, then okay. So now we talk about ID selectors. And actually, this gives me a really good opportunity to bring up best practice that Scott didn't actually follow in a couple of these later slides, but I'm going to bring it up anyway. And I wouldn't use the word class here. I would have actually used the word rule. But when you want a rule to apply to any appropriate element only once per page, you use what they call an ID selector. An ID selector starts with the hash mark. Some people call that the pound sign. If you're a Harvard snob, you call that the octothorpe.
Octothorpe.
Octothorpe,
okay.
Right? And so what this means is the CSS engine is going to look for an element. It doesn't care about the element name, and it doesn't care about class. It doesn't care about any of that. This rule only cares about what your ID has been set to. And officially, in XML anyway, and I think it's best practice, you should never have more than one element in the same page with the same ID. IDs, in other words, should be unique within the same page. So what happens is that this selector says, find any element that has navigation as its ID and apply the rule. So it finds a P. Could be anything because doesn't care that there's no P in front of this, so that thing could be an HR, spam, whatever you want. As long as it has an ID of that, it will end up green and 14 point.
Shouldn't the color be, number be 00FF00?
Doesn't have to be. This is a shorthand.
Oh.
If you have the same, and I don't know, it's the hex arithmetic. But if it's the same thing, this is the same thing as 00FF00.
Oh.
So if you've got the same thing, you can drop out. It's just an option in CSS.
That also complies with web colors, recommended web colors?
For the web safe colors, the ones that
work right.
Yeah. That more or less is starting to kind of fade as things become more powerful, but it's still not a bad thing to follow if you don't need a full, more of a color palette than whatever, 217 or whatever.
Well, the issue is that you can't guarantee how red you're going to
be. That's right, yeah.
The other one.
Yeah. Now, what you're starting to see people move more toward is specifying an RGB color in here, partly because an advanced feature of CSS3 is the ability to specify an RGBA color, which allows you to specify an alpha channel and it'll give the element a certain level of transparency. And you can't do that with a hex.
Well, that is RGB.
It is, but the I mean the syntax being RGB paren and then the three numbers, right? Like this, right? So it's RGB and then you know whatever, you know 205, 205, 205, right? And you can actually
255 actually.
Yeah, but I mean it could be any number from 0 to 255, okay. Right? So you could put that instead of that, right? Yes, sir.
So for the transparency level, you simply add?
Yeah, you put RGBA instead, and then you put a fourth parameter here, 0.5.
Okay. So.
And that will not work in IE, even IE8.
I thought they were trying to get away from RGB, and it seems like they've come full circle.
Yeah.
I got an HT.
There's also HSB colors in CSS3. You can specify hue, saturation, and brightness in the same sort of thing. So they're really just, it's part of the standard. I mean, you know, you can use it or not. Okay. So ID selectors. Oh, so I was going to talk about best practices. Later on, we're going to, and I'll mention it then too, we're going to see where people put inline style on their elements. Where you see people in HTML say style equals da 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 da. That's really not a best practice. And the reason is it's really hard to maintain.
It is bulky.
And it is bulky. And so you end up transmitting the same stuff. You know, a CSS file comes over into the browser, just like an HTML or JavaScript file or whatever, and it gets cached. So if that's not changing, you're really leveraging the browser's cache. If you repeat that style information in style equals and you know. Pages over and over and over again. It's not very efficient, and it's also really difficult to maintain. So, interestingly enough, in the XHTML2 effort, which has now been suspended and probably terminated, they were actually going to get rid of the style attribute, and everybody freaked out. And they said, "Well, how am I going to specify style that I only want for that element?" And the answer was, use an ID selector, since you're only really supposed to have one element with an ID in the page anyway. Put that rule in your style sheet with an ID selector.
Well, and wasn't XHTML2, isn't it being sort of like rolled into HTML5?
Nah, there are certain aspects of it, but there's large portions that will not be. But that was definitely a best practice that came out of it that I really latched onto because I've seen lots of occasions where people, you know, would use style equals and then just spray all sorts of stuff into their pages. And it's really difficult to debug, too, because a lot of times you're looking at the style sheet, you're saying, why is this ending up this way? Oh, well, because some page generator in the server somewhere sends that over, and then you got to use some debugging tool to dig around in there and figure out what's going on. So it's just better to not use that stuff. And I'll mention it again when Scott, you see it in his stuff, and I'll have to slap his hand. So here's rules for CSS ID names. Again, you know, I would personally stay away from the punctuation, but that's just a personal preference. Obviously, don't use spaces and don't use things that are going to confuse the parser as to, you know, what the name is as opposed to the function of it. So, here's some bad names, here's some good names.
Question.
Yes.
Here. So, ID versus class.
Uh-huh.
Meaning they're so damn close.
They are. But here's the point. First of all, obviously, IDs are supposed to be unique within the document. Now, you could say the same thing about a class. You could say, I'm going to come up with the most unique class name, and I'm never going to use it on any other element. I'm going to say class equals my foo element, and I'm just not going to use it anywhere else.
That would work.
Where it starts to differ, and we'll talk very briefly about this, my more sophisticated talk goes into depth in this, is when you're trying to determine when a selector actually applies, there's a weighting algorithm that CSS uses. And ID selectors get more of a weight than the class selector does. Okay. So if you had two overriding rules, let's say you had an ID equals foo and class equals bar, you had them in your sheet, and you had hash foo, blah, 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 with a font of 12. And you had dot bar, blah, 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 with a font of 20. how does the CSS engine know which one to apply? You put them on both of them on your element, right? And actually, the class has come after the ID one rule in that case. So it looks at it and goes, ah, but that's an ID selector. Because IDs are supposed to be unique and classes don't have to be, I'm going to lend more weight to the ID selector, and I'm going to make it the make its rule apply.
And that's weight like in heaviness, not in time.
That's correct.
Yeah. It waits longer to evaluate.
Right, no. W-E-I-G-H-T. Yes. Yes, sir.
I guess the way I look at it is IDs are unique, so that if you don't use that ID, if you put IDs in the elements in the document, it makes it easier to debug the document and to make changes. So I see it quite often where people will take every table element and give it an ID number. Mm-hmm. So you can actually see the table hierarchy.
Another thing about that is your JavaScript can address things by ID.
That's true. That's true. Now there's, you know, as the years have gone on, we have more sophisticated ways of querying from JavaScript. But yeah, it's easy. It's nice to be able to say, you know, these days it's a dollar something and you can get the ID back, you know, you can get an element back rather quickly. That's the other thing about IDs. If you want to think about, again, from a database perspective, IDs are indexed. IDs are your, you know, they're, if you use them correctly, they can be like a key. And so the actual engine inside of the browser does create a hash. And so when you say, you know, ID, boom, it just bang, it just you just got it right there. It just hands it back to you. So it's very fast. Any other questions? Okay. I'm going to keep moving here. Because, sorry. Okay, so we were talking about selector grouping. Ah, okay. So sometimes, like let's say I wanted all P's, block quotes, TDs, and options to have the same two declarations, the same two things applied to them. Well, I could have said P and then that, and then block quote and then that, and then TD and then that, and then option and then that. So, you know, it's a lot to type and maintenance and so forth. So you can take any selector here, any selector at all, and you can just comma separate them and then put your declaration block. And that will apply to all of them. And that would include class and ID selectors. You could also put the, he doesn't show that here, but you could also have, you know, hash foo at the end of that, comma hash foo, and it would take those. Just a nice way of avoiding repetition in your CSS file. So you kind of get, and it's nice because you can line out a whole set of elements that way, put the couple of declarations in, and you end up with a nice unified look. So now we'll talk about the universal selector, which is star. Gee, these guys are creative, aren't they? Star. Might as well just reuse what Unix had. Right?
So use percent sign.
That's true. So star basically means every element in the document. In some ways, this is not all that useful, except in this particular case when you want to apply it to every element. It becomes a little more useful when you get more sophisticated things going on that we're not going to talk about here, like things called attribute selectors and things like that, because you can use star to your advantage. But in this particular case, really just it's every element in the whole document.
Useful for things like when you've got varied backgrounds, you can use star to change the font color to match the background.
It's true.
And then a class can write it.
That's right. Yeah.
Or a type selector.
Yeah. Star, the star has the least specificity. It's least weighted. So his contention is this. I don't really like this example that much because he only shows four elements here. You'd have to show all 97. So imagine there's all 97 elements listed out.
Not all 97 have font family and font size.
That's true, but
like
you
for HR, it doesn't make sense.
Right. You could still list them out that way. It is kind of up to the browser as to how it's going to render, because the browser CSS contains more important rules sometimes that are delineated the bang important. And so they'll override this behavior and not allow that to be set, for instance, in an HR.
Unless you add it.
Unless you add it important, and then you can play the game, right? We can all play the game back and forth, trying to override each other's rules.
Does it matter? Sometimes I see a capital and sometimes not.
It doesn't for HTML, because HTML, being based on SGML, is a case-insensitive language. You can write your tags in either upper or lower case. XHTML, because it's an XML-based language, which is case-sensitive, has decided that they're going to go with lowercase for everything. That's why you're starting to see, in general, people go with lowercase for all their tag names. I'm not sure what the HTML5 guys are going to do in this regard. One thing I do know about HTML5, which is a very interesting thing I read the other day, and then it kind of dawned on me that, wow, that gives them license to do whatever they want, is that HTML, as of version 5, will no longer be strictly an SGML language. So they could come along and say, we're going to make everything lowercase, whether you like it or not, because we're not bound by the rules of SGML anymore. Okay. This is kind of an interesting rule. Basically, there's things called margin and padding that you have in an element in HTML. Margin is the thing that's outside of the border of an element. Padding are the things that are inside the border of an element. If you want to set all that to zero for everything, sometimes the browser has built-in things for the body. So, you know, the body will come in like 8 or 10 pixels, and you'll think, I want mine to go all the way out to the edge of the window. Well, this is kind of an interesting way of setting it. You can say every element should have no margin and padding. So now we talk a little bit about combinators. So I'm going to take a quick pause here. Are there questions before we move into combinators? Now we're going to start getting our query language a little more sophisticated. Okay. I'm going to talk first about the descending combinator. Sometimes you hear people that the older term for this was actually descendant selector, but they've tried to be a little more precise now. Descendant combinator. What it means, combinator just means that I can combine multiple selectors, multiple what they call simple selectors, into a more complex expression. So what we see here is a TD followed by a space followed by a P. The space indicates a descendant combinator. That's the descendant combinator, is a space. What that means is any P's that are under that TD, TD is a table cell. So any P's that are within the table cell, even if they're under other elements that are in the table cell. So I might have a TD and then I might have, you know, a P. But then at the same level as that P, I might have a span. But then a P underneath that. This will match all of those. Okay? This will match all of those. It could be a child, grandchild, so forth. It can be any, if you look at HTML as a tree, it can be any child, any descendant under that tree.
Right? That could be handy.
It's very handy. It can also be very maddening. Until IE7, they only supported this selector, and there were times when you didn't want it to descend under other stuff. So you couldn't terminate the query easily, and you ended up with this mess, and it was very difficult to get around. So we'll talk about, since IE7, they've updated that support, thankfully. Questions on the descendant combinator and how that works. So this could be a class. I could say TD space dot emphasis or foo or whatever, right? And that would mean any element under there, under TD, would get matched, that had that class would get matched.
So that class would apply inside TDs, but that same class would apply differently outside of the TD.
Very well might, yeah. Depending on the rule, and you know, I have another rule that says dot foo outside of that. But only these declarations would only apply to elements with that class if they were under a TD, but they could be anywhere under the TD. Okay. And like I said, so you'll see people talk about descendant selectors it's a little more precise to say descendant combinator because now they've added a bunch. And you know. So, I was just telling Dan about maddening. Sometimes you don't want every descendant underneath that thing to have that style. You only want direct children, right? So I have a TD, just the P's that are right under that, not P's that are further down in that chunk of tree that's under that TD. Mm-hmm. So we have a greater than sign, and that's the child, they call the child combinator. And that means only a direct child, only one level down inside of the TD.
And I'm sorry, this is called?
The child combinator. The other one's the descendant. To them, descendant means your grandchildren, your grandchildren, your children. Yeah, all the way down in this whole chunk of tree. Direct child is the greater than sign. Any questions on that?
So that kind of ties the P to the...
That's right.
Okay, so if you can have, you get your table there, and it could be in the middle of the table, but there's a P there. That's not going
to
apply.
That's correct. It has to be right under the TD.
In this particular instance, it would be a bold, the first header.
Right. But you don't want the things underneath that to get this rule, which is why using descendant combinator can be maddening sometimes, because it's applying when you don't want it to.
Right.
Because you've got stuff under there. No, I want that to. And so then you would have to go in and apply more, write more specific rules to override that descendantness. With this, you don't have to do that anymore. Yeah. Okay. This one was added in CSS 3, but it's actually supported by IE 7. One of the very few things.
It was an accident.
Yeah. Actually, no, literally the release note read when I read it from Microsoft in the beta that they released of IE 7, whenever that was, 3 years ago, said, well, we were in the code anyway. So we figured we'd go ahead and add the two sibling selectors. Well, how very nice. Isn't that great? Thanks. Glad you guys are making world-class stuff. Okay. So what this means is that... So it's a plus. The character is a plus. And what this means is that if I have something right next to something else, directly following it, okay, it will apply. This isn't used very much, but it does come in really handy sometimes when you say, I'm coming along here and I've gotten to this point and then I want this thing to be, you know, bold or whatever, and it's nice to be able to say plus that.
This could be like your menu down the side has an element here of one class and an element next
that's,
or
that's,
one styling and an element next to it that's a different style.
That's right, yeah. So it comes in handy. It's one of those things you don't use a lot, but when you need it, you really need it. Nice to have. Here's one that's really not used very much at all. This one is a tilde, and what that means is any sibling, whether it follows me or not, would get the style. It's not used a lot, but I put it in here for completeness. It's actually a CSS3-ism. What's really fun is to actually open up the browser's CSS. If you're a Firefox user in particular, it's pretty easy to find. And you'll see all these wild rules as to how they actually lay out the page. It's kind of fun.
What was that called?
This is the general sibling selector.
Yeah. It just has to be next to it. It doesn't have to be before it or after.
That's correct. Yeah. It doesn't have to be following it. It can just be on the same level. As long as it's a sibling.
But not even next to it. So.
It can be anywhere.
Anywhere inside
that's right.
The same container.
That's correct. Yep. They all have a common parent, mm-hmm. if you want to think of it that way.
Sibling combinator or
combinator. I probably didn't actually change it. So there's two elements that were put into HTML that come in really handy when you're trying to style things that don't have any semantic meaning other than here's some stuff. And that's span and div. And I don't think he actually talks about the difference between span and div. Anybody want to take a gander? Span, yeah, go ahead.
Well, they're containers that you're going to assign classes and stuff to.
Right.
And div gives you, well, let's see. I believe there is a break option you can use to define how the line breaks and stuff are assigned. Typically, a div gives you a line break afterwards, and a span does not.
Yeah.
But divs take position and spans don't, right?
Well, it depends. It depends on how you want to set. You can set position, but not necessarily. What it really is that divs give you what's called block. They're defined by the CSS rule, really, to have a block level display, what they call it, this display property is a block. And spans don't. Spans have an inline. So a block you might use as an overall, you know, blocky container on the screen. Now you can position that if you want. You know, if you don't position it, it still goes into the document flow. It's just, as Don said, it kind of gives you, in a sense, if you're using mostly text, it kind of gives you this notion of a line break because it's a block. Spans don't. It's more of an inline. You know, you just find some
divs
span.
Divs you can overlay and turn off, but spans you can't.
I'm sorry?
Divs you can overlay and turn off, make them invisible, but spans you can't. That's what I meant to say.
It depends. You can actually take spans and make them invisible. You can actually also remove them from the content of the document, as you can with divs. It's a bit of a semantic whatever, because I've gone in before and set divs to have an inline display value, and it works. It's just, it's normally how people tend to break things out, divs and spans. Yeah, Craig.
And there's also a difference on where you can use them within other elements.
That's true.
The easiest way to think about it is divs are usually bigger things and spans are
right. But that's a really good point, actually. The first point you brought up is that where you use it very well might be where you can legally use it in the document, depending on the HTML DKD.
I don't think you can use a div inside a paragraph.
That very well may be. You know, certain elements can have children children of other elements. So Scott's point here is that most HTML elements work, and what he means by work is they have some visual layout, right? You can see them visually on the screen. They do something without attributes and values, except for an image tag and a link tag. But, span and div are really designed solely as a placeholder. They really don't do anything. They have no visible representation. It's probably a better way to say than do nothing. They actually do something. They section off content. But they don't visibly appear. There's nothing there visually. They have to have some sort of CSS value attached to them, some rule attached to them in order to actually do something. So, it's talking about span.
Well, if you don't have something attached to them, the text contained inside them still appears. It just isn't.
That's true. It's just there's no visual effect. Right? I mean, it displays. It in fact, it takes its inherited CSS rules on up its tree. But that's, you know. So it's kind of an inline structure. You can enclose things in spans and then add classes to them, put an ID on them, you know, whatever. Kind of this general container. His point here is that if you're going to, you know, do the same thing with a class over again and all you're trying to do is get some sort of visual representation for your text, you can actually use some pre-built CSS, HTML classes that do that. Strong and M.
That should have gone away.
Not Strong and M.
Which were the ones going away?
Oh, you're right. Strong won't go. Isn't going to go away. Bold is going to go away.
Okay.
Right. Italic's going to go away. There was about 6 or 8 of them.
Because Strong and M were the universal ones. The bold and italic were the U.S. creations.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a list, and we can look it up afterwards because I have the slide on here. Anyway, his thing is that you can actually define those in your browser and it'll pick them up if you want.
So if they do go away, you're covered.
Yeah. Sure.
Or if they're defined some other way.
Right. The browser might define them in another way, and then your style sheet would want to override that, set it back that way. Div is virtually the same thing, except it's a block level structure rather than being an inline level structure in the HTML. You can, you know, shoved a bunch of keys inside of a div, put some classes on them, and it's just a way of blocking out and being able to address that data. from a database perspective, it's like, you know, you shove stuff in and put a label on it so that then you get a handle back to it. And here's another example of doing that. So we're going to, any questions on any of that? Okay, we're going to briefly cover inheritance. There's two main concepts when talking about application of rules in CSS. There's inheritance and there's the cascade. I'll talk first about inheritance. If I have a P, if I have a rule for all P's defined this way, and I have a rule for this class of emphasis defined in this way, right? Then what's going to happen here, if I wrap this P and I wrap Seamus in this class of emphasis, right? What's basically going to happen here is this P must have done for his class. What is, you know, actually I'll ask someone here, what does Seamus look like and why? As if I'm very pedagogical. Yes, sir.
He'll be 12 pixel times New Roman serif bold.
Right. And how about the text that's outside of, and they, how about the, and they called him?
That will be 12 pixel times New Roman serif light.
Right, normal weight.
Or whatever it
right.
is.
Whatever it's been, right. Yeah. Does everybody see what happened here? The span inherited these two values, right? And then because it was also wrapped in this thing, it also made itself bold. So this is a good example of inheritance. The text Seamus is inheriting its font size and font family because it's also wrapped in this overall P, and it's inheriting, it's getting its font weight because it's been wrapped in the span. Yes, sir.
I need to back up just a little bit.
Yeah.
The font size, is that always pixel? In other words, right now I'm using pretty much everything as the in OpenOffice, the font size as the point.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So, can I use point or does it have to be pixel?
Nope. You can use, there's a whole set of unit values for CSS, point, pixel, and M, and X, and all sorts of stuff. You can use a percentage. You can say there's some pre-built ones, small and large.
You use small, medium, and large.
Small, medium, and large. Those are relative sizes, right?
Okay.
Which really helps sometimes. You know, when you zoom up, you know, your content, sometimes depends on the browser. I used to take this cheat where it actually would size things a little differently depending on where you have set your zoom. Sometimes relative, you know, I actually in general don't tend to recommend 12 and let, you know, or absolute sizes like pixels unless you really, you know, really want to set it to 12.
Because also larger and smaller?
There is larger and smaller. I mean, there's a whole set of values.
Yeah. But for easy conversion, though, can I still use point?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, because points will scale with the rendering engine.
And
right?
If you zoom, the point will get bigger.
It'll get bigger, yeah. So so that's inheritance, and we all see how that worked. You inherited the values through the DOM structure, through the tree structure that HTML provides. So his whole thing was a selector inside of a selector, or I would say element inside of an element, inherits the outermost element's properties all the way through. Now, there are certain properties that don't inherit, border and padding. Some of the other ones actually, as values, will not inherit down through because it would really mess your markup up. This is all in all the various books that do CSS. They always have a big table at the back that shows all the different properties and what sorts of things they inherit from and don't. Or which ones are inheritable and which ones aren't. Right. So then he talks about C being inside of B, right? So I've got the innermost nested one is C, then that's wrapped in B, then that's wrapped in A. B inherits from A, C inherits from B and A, right? However, if A says font size is 12 and C says font size is 10, then C is going to win for whatever's wedged inside of C. All right, if I had something wedged between the closing B and the closing A, then it's going to be 12 pixels. Daily. Does that make sense? Okay. Style sheets also cascade. This is where CSS can get a little more complicated. So we talk about in CSS, the most important things are the things that are marked important. And that sounds a little silly, but I think we'll see an example of that. Then we have this notion of specificity, which things are more specific. We already talked a little bit about that when we talked about ID versus class. ID selectors are more specific than class selectors because you can put a class selector anywhere. IDs are supposed to be unique within the document. And then the order. And this is actually how the browser determines which rules are going to apply when there's a conflict. This is 8:45 at night. It's tough to go through this stuff. But, you know, just hang in there.
I was doing fine just in the last 5 minutes. It's like my eyes are...
It's starting to go, okay.
Yeah.
Just, you know, big oxygen uptake, and then blow it out. Okay, we're almost there. We only got a few more slides left here. Okay, so specified CSS wins over default CSS. All that means is that if the browser has a built-in style sheet, and we saw that with the M tag and the other one, and you go in and override it, it means your rules are going to take effect, and you're going to tell the browser to go away. Right? Class selectors win over element selectors. So, if I had a P and I had a font size, that's all I have is P, an element selector. If I have dot foo and I have another font size, on my P tag, I said P class equals foo. The foo one is going to win, because it is more specific than the P is. Does that make sense to folks? Because I could have lots of P's, but only a few of them are going to have that class on them, maybe. And in that case, I would want those guys to get their more specific font size than all the other P's are getting. Okay? We already talked about this. ID selectors win over class. So if I not only have P's, a bunch of P's, then I have a bunch of P's with the class, you know, a subset of those with the class on them, and then I've got one that says, you know, ID equals bar, that guy is going to win for that element over all the other rules. Right? What we're talking about here, what we're trying to do is resolve conflicts. So imagine in these rules that I'm talking about that every one of these things has font size and then a different value. It's like, oh, okay, but now I have this element. It's got an ID selector on it. It's a P. It's got an ID selector and it's got a class selector. Which of those rules wins, right, in defining font size? And so this is the algorithm that the browser uses to determine which one wins. Okay? Then this, what's called inline CSS, the thing that we said not to use, the style equals, that wins actually over everybody. So if you really want it, then you can go in there and put that unmaintainable style equals on there and say, no, by God, you're going to be font size 8. Care.
Oh, God.
six.
Right. So let's say that I had a class of foo with a font size and I had a class of bar with a font size. On my P tag, I don't have an ID selector. I don't have anything else. But I have P, and actually something he doesn't mention here is you can put multiple class names in that class equals. You can say class equals, quote, foo space bar, quote. You can put multiple class names in there. So let's say I did that. Let's say I had P class foo space bar, and I have two rules, dot foo, blah, 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 font size equals 10, dot bar, font size equals 12. Which one wins in that case? They're both weighted the same, because class selectors, they're both going to win on specificity, or they're both going to come out equal on specificity. There's no ID on it. Does anybody gander a guess as to which one wins when they're both weighted equally?
The later one.
That's right. Yeah. The one that comes later. So bar will win because foo was first and then bar came. They were both weighted equally. The element just had those two classes on it, no other ID or anything else. So it says, okay. So the cascade rules are applied in this order. I don't think he actually talks about bang important, and as far as I'm concerned, that's fine, because that's a whole other, that's another 20-minute part talk. So, actually, here's a great example. This is the example that I was just talking about. He's got blue and red, and then he's got red and blue, right? Because I was just saying that class attribute can have multiple values in it, space separated. So which color am I
going to
be?
It's going to be the blue.
Nope. The reason it's red is this here means nothing as far as order. This is meaningless. It's just a list. The CSS processor is not going to take this into consideration at all, except it's going to know that both of those classes at some level should apply to this element. What it's going to look is at the order of the rules here. And since this one came after in the style sheet, so since this one came after that, and I should have probably made that clear, this order means nothing.
That's very non-intuitive.
And,
yeah.
Confused me. When my buddy started at Google, a guy turned around to him about the second day he was there, and he said, I can't get this to work, and it was exactly this problem. So you got people there who, you know, who are supposed to be like Mr. Web, right? That company's supposed to be Mr. Web and everything. I ain't getting it. So this is, yeah.
It's actually more useful. The way that it isn't is the more useful.
I don't disagree. I think you're right. It would have been great had they decided to do that, because then you could have gotten, you could have determined on the element, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. I don't know. I like it this way better.
Yeah. When I first started doing this, I was confused too. I thought the order meant something.
Especially
and it doesn't.
If that's on a different page, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially if it's on multiple pages, like you can have dot blue defined in different.
So then I think he just does the inverse here. He just inverts them, and so now it's blue. And this order means the order in which, after the browser has already resolved all the file references. So let's say you've got stylesheet 1.css, stylesheet 2.css, and you've got them all linked into your thing. We'll see that real briefly here. It's after it's already sucked them all in, so the browser goes in and traverses all the links, sucks them all in, and lists them out, and then it makes these kinds of determinations after that happens. So this is integrating CSS in with your page. Real quick, inline style. There's basically three basic ways to do this. Inline style is the style equals, right? This is the most specific. If you want to just jam it on there and you don't care what anybody else says, you put it on there. It's not recommended, but you can do it. And before, you would have used the font tag. That's another one that's going away in HTML5.
Good riddance.
Okay, so there you go. Right? You use the style attribute. That's called inline style. Quick and easy to create, time-consuming to manage, maintain, repeat it over and over. You can't actually use what they call media rules, which CSS has this notion of, if you're running it on a device that's like a mobile device, the mobile device can actually tell CSS, use a different sheet, because I'm running on a mobile device. You can't do that if you inline the style hard right into the markup. It doesn't separate content and presentation, so you're really kind of back to where we were pre-CSS. You know, again, if they're totally unique, and you really want that overriding behavior, you can use it, but I've gotten to the point, I've written thousands of lines of HTML. Never use style anymore at all.
Nope.
Yes. Okay. Sorry. I think we're almost to the end. You can also place it in the head of your HTML document. And when you do that, use the style tag. Now, make sure and put type equals text CSS. Make sure and put type equals the mind type for CSS, which is text CSS. And then put your rules in. Okay? That's just defining an inline in the head. This goes in the head of your HTML document. Great for one page, rapidly become difficult to manage. Again, you're back to a maintenance issue, right? If you want to change something, you've got to go to all your pages and change it. So the best way to do it is do linking, create an external sheet. It's a text file. It's just a text file ending in CSS, .css, and you link to them using the link HTML, you say rel equals style sheet. All of these things are required, by the way. Rel equals style sheet, type again, the mind type of CSS, text/CSS, and the href, which should be the path. Okay? Any questions on this stuff? It's pretty straightforward. naming conventions. A lot of people kind of tend to follow this thing about having a main client search. I mean, so those kinds of things are more how your site is structured and really how you want to do it. This is just a best practice sort of naming convention thing. You can name it foo.css for, you know, for all the browser cares. It doesn't matter. Scott recommends, again, having this directory structure under your root directory of images, scripts, and styles, and putting them in styles. Again, that's kind of personal preference. I've backed off lately of telling people they have to do stuff. I think I'm getting old. I think that's what it is. So here was something that he created for this company, Colostomo. Scott's silly sense of humor. And so here's basically just a style sheet, and it just goes on. You'll notice CSS, you put comments with the slash star. CSS does not support the double slash at the beginning of a line, which I absolutely hate, because I'm used to doing that all the time. So you have to use slash star, star slash.
But you can put them on separate lines, which is
you can.
Better than nothing.
You can.
As a piece of trivia.
Yes, sir.
The slash star and star slash, that is the comments from Rex.
Huh.
Oh, wow.
Interesting.
Huh.
Cool.
Rex.
From Rex. R-E-double-X.
Yep.
Which was a scripting language for the IBM 360 series.
For the mainframe.
Okay. Yep. Cool. I learned something tonight. That's very cool. I love it.
Precede C? The original C-style comment.
Pardon?
Precede C?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I think that's where, Richie
it started,
and...
It started...
got it from.
Got it from C.
Right.
Oh, gosh, I remember seeing those in C.
Yeah. So, he highly recommends you comment your CSS. I do as well. Just like you would comment code. I mean, same arguments for commenting CSS. You can also comment your HTML. I don't know how many people know that you can do comments with a greater than, bang, dash, dash, blah, 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 dash, dash, or less than, and then greater than at the end. CSS comment. Use external style sheets. One change, you can change the entire way your document looks. He has a whole thing here about tools, some various tools that run on Windows that help you do your CSS. I'm not even going to worry all that much about them. There's more tools. Anywhere from $39 to $99. Sorry, Gary. CSS edit. This is actually a nice little editor. It shows you your how things get rendered over here. And if you want to use a tool, here's some Mozilla development tools. There is a CSS validator up at the W3, so you can run your CSS through it, and it'll tell you all the problems with it. It's kind of nice.
You may not want to do it, though.
May not want to do it.
Yeah.
Well, you want to if do you go to graneman.com and just follow the links, he's got a whole load of stuff in there on CSS, and he's got a whole set of delicious bookmarks on CSS. Here's Eric Meyer. He's like Mr. CSS. This book, actually, the one thing I do have to say for this book, it's now in its third edition. This is the book. Now, it's a book that's a little more referencey. But if you want to know whether the font size property inherits, you'll find it in that book, and then go in and it'll tell you that it inherits and it does this and it does that, and or this kind of element is an inline element that takes this, and I mean it is like the book, and it's Eric Meyer's book, and it's the standard, the gold standard for the CSS. Really how it works, and you'll learn about 10 times more in this book than you learned here tonight. This is an okay book. I don't know. Scott was promoting it because it might have been one of his publishers. This was Eric Meyer's book. This is like basically took 13 projects and broke them out. One of the things I like about a couple of his projects in this book and in this book, which is a more book, it's a second volume of that, is that he showed how I'm going to take stuff from old HTML and convert it to strip out a bunch of HTML and then use CSS to do it, to replicate it, and how much crap he got rid of and all of that, and how much. So these are two kind of cool books. I own them both. And thanks.
You're welcome.
Yeah. So, yeah, let me just ask.
2 minutes to spare.
Yeah.
Well, 1 minute.
Another book I'd recommend is called Designing with Web Standards.
Yes, that's a good book.
The third edition just came out. I already own the first two, but I'm going to go buy the third.
Yeah, that's a good book.
It sort of tells you why you should do these kinds of things.
That's right. Yeah.
There's also a companion book coming out called Developing with Web Standards.
Hmm. Yeah, yeah. Very good. Cool. Yes, sir.
Problem I had when I was tinkering a little bit, when you were talking about the directory structure where you had like the style sheets and images, anytime you have an image that is called from your a style sheet, which if you use it for a heading or something, you can do that in the style sheet.
That's right. That's right.
It's important to note that the location of that file is relative to the location of the style sheet itself.
That's right.
So what I did is like under he had a styles directory. Under that you'd have an images directory, so you can have the images that are all from the style sheet.
Right.
For there.
Right.
If you put it in the images directory,
yeah, it's
won't find it.
Those paths are not resolved relative to the root, they're resolved relative to the style sheet. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that could be fun.
Yeah. Just these are little interesting quirks. I'm glad folks are paying attention to bring stuff like that up, because that can be a pain.
Do we know? Are we going to be able to post the...
I'm sure that I made some mods to these, but I don't think he cares. He had put a Creative Commons thing at the end of his other thing. So, and I chatted with him about it the other day. So, let me real check with him real quick, then I can shut him up on it.
Okay. What post this on
Graneman.com, right? You usually go there and get his...
Yeah, stuff. You go to Graneman.com, you can get all of his stuff, too. Okay. But, okay. But I'll ask him about it, you know.
And we'll post that on Discuss where you can find the URL to get to this presentation. That's it. Bill Edney, thank you very much. Bill said he will be found eating and drinking with something.
That's right. So ask your questions early, because the more than I hear. That's true, and it could. That's true.